Like, yeah, it was pretty late. I told you, like, I did it. It's the right way. I
I just sent these slides out a few minutes ago, so maybe an hour and a half, but if you got a chance to download them, say if not, not a big deal. I'll put it up online. I'll also put the entire, I mean, it's on the Google Share spreadsheet now, but I'll also create an Excel spreadsheet to get download everybody's analysis of every something. couple of quick reminders. I'll take your names out, so don't worry, your name.
Hey, can you guys hear me on Zoom?
Yeah.
Yep.
How about now? Can you hear me still?
It's a little choppier now.
Better, right?
You want to get
use the old-fashioned mic until we get something going. So the slide should be with you, but a couple of reminders. One is the early final is this Thursday from 10 to 12. There's a sign-up sheet. I noticed many of you have already signed up. So you know you can keep, I mean, if you decide on Wednesday to sign up, that's still okay. But I need to know by about 5 o'clock on Wednesday in case I need to get a bigger room because I've got 170 and should fit 130 people. I don't think we'll have that many. So I don't think there'll be a constraint if you want to take it on Thursday. Otherwise the regular final is on next Monday. So let's talk about what I was planning to do actually today was use what you told me you found on your project as a way of reviewing the entire class. So let's start with a few things that I think we all perhaps agree on after working on a company for 15 or 16 weeks. First is, you know, as you start looking at the numbers, you realize very quickly that there are very few facts on the ground. That what you thought was a fact is more an opinion than a fact. I mean, even the givens, the risk-free rate, think of how much it's changed in the 15 weeks since you started the class. It was 1.5% at the start of the semester, it's now 3%. Now, even things like cash, you have disagreement on exactly how much cash a company is. When you look at the accounting and the market numbers, it's all over the place. Now, I know quite a few of you came up to me and said, now I've been looking at Bloomberg, I'm looking at Capital IQ, I'm looking at my own company's annual reports. Numbers like operating income don't seem to be the same, even though it's for the most recent year, it's the same company. So I think if there's something I hope you take out of this is be very cautious about numbers that come from services, especially if they're computed numbers. Like a debt ratio on Capital IQ might not be the debt ratio that you want to think about for your company. It's best for you to compute the numbers from scratch, even if they seem simple, because that way you control the process. The second is, especially after the last 15 weeks, you know, the world's a really messy place. And one of the problems with analyzing a company in real time is real things happen. I don't think any of you picked a Russian company to analyze, but imagine what the last 15 weeks would have felt like if you'd picked Severstal to do. There's actually somebody in one of my other classes who's valuing a Russian company. And to give the person credit, he stuck with the Russian company through the 15 weeks. I know he was tempted, but he stuck with the Russian company. So some of your companies, at the start of the year, I told you to pick a money-making company. But halfway through the semester, a few of you emailed me and said, I started what I thought was a money-making company, but it's become a money-losing company. Nothing you can do about it. It is what it is. You know? Some of your companies had restructurings. I know at least a couple of people in this class were doing Twitter. And potential restructuring, you can already start to see things changing. And finally, while we don't talk about politics and government in this class, they intrude into the space constantly. Whether you like it or not, they become part of your analysis. One final point, and I know I fed you a lot of Excel spreadsheets, and for some of you, they did become black boxes because you had to get things done, especially the valuation part. Somebody's got their mic open. Okay. So as you were working, now it's okay, right? As you were working through the models, one of the things I think you started to feel, the model's computing the optimal debt ratio, the model's computing the valuation. Trust me, the model's doing nothing. It is your tool. It might feel like it has a life of its own, that it's taken on some special role, but it just takes the numbers you're inputting and reflecting it back. It takes a little while for you to get in control of the model, but whatever you do, don't let a model run you, because that's going to be at some point in time the risk you run with these big complex models. So with that structure, let me start off by listing the companies that were most picked for analysis. So these were the top five. Netflix was picked by four people, Amazon by four, Nike by four, Chipotle by three. I used to sit and wonder, why do people pick the companies they do? I'm convinced that it just is based on what you're doing at a point in time. So you're sitting there saying, I haven't picked a company, I'm watching Netflix, let me do Netflix. Krispy Kreme used to show up all the time. There's no good reason why people pick Krispy Kreme other than the fact that you're eating Krispy Kreme, you haven't picked a company. You say, okay, let me pick Krispy Kreme. There's one company I'm glad didn't make this list that's made this list every single year for probably the last decade. I hate Lululemon. I just absolutely hate it as a company because I've read so many analyses of Lululemon that I wish it would just go away. But clearly, multiple people pick companies, and this puzzles people because
I know early on, because you could see what other people had picked in that Google Master spreadsheet, at least a couple of people came in and said, well, somebody else has picked Netflix to analyze. Is it okay if I do? And my answer always has been, it doesn't matter how many people pick the same company. And here's why. I took your Netflix analyses. I took your summaries. I haven't messed with the numbers. In fact, I touched only a few numbers simply because they didn't seem plausible. You know, you had three extra zeros. I took the three zeros out. I hope I didn't do something that I shouldn't have done. But these were the four Netflix submissions. You can see on every single dimension, there's disagreement, right? From where the power lies. The betas are pretty close, but you can see that even among betas, there's a little bit of a shift. I guess depending on when in the semester you printed off the beta page. The R squareds are close. The bottom-up levered beta is close except for, I think, the second group, but that comes directly from the fact that the debt ratio for one of the submissions is significantly lower than the rest. Now, I don't know whether the difference can be entirely explained by it, but somebody doing Netflix, can you tell me what the item was that could be included in debt or could not be? What was the questionable item? Content obligations, right? Because content obligations are like lease obligations. If you treat them as debt, it pushes up your debt ratio. And if you don't, it brings down your debt ratio. There's no right or wrong, but the question you got to ask is, should I be treating that as debt? And that can cause differences. My point is, it doesn't matter if 12 people do the same company. You get differences depending on timing, depending on how you make judgments on variables on which there's some discretion. So with that set up, let's go back to the very beginning. We spent about four sessions starting this class, where I don't think I talked about a single number. It was all about corporate governance and where does the power lie. And just reviewing what we talked about four set of linkages that drive how we think about corporate finance. The first is a linkage between stockholders and managers. How much power do stockholders have over managers, and what do managers do in response? And we concluded that for the most part, in most companies, stockholders have little or no power over managers, and managers often put their interests over shareholder interests. Many of you saw this at your companies as you started to assess where does the power lie. Second, we looked at bondholders and managers. You lend money to a firm, you don't protect yourself, you're going to get ripped off. Remember, we introduced the Nabisco word into at least the business language, that if you lend money and you don't protect yourself, you risk being Nabisco. Third, we talked about the relationship between managers and markets. In the utopian world, managers might tell the truth and reveal information on time, but in the real world, that sometimes breaks down. So when you look at managers and markets, you're looking at the fact that managers often hold back information. They sometimes are deceptive in how they reveal information. And in a few cases, they commit outright fraud. And markets are not exactly angelic. They don't react always the way they should. In the last few weeks, you've seen earnings reports come out in really big companies. You see $60 billion, $50 billion, $100 billion in market cap being written off in one fell swoop. I think Amazon lost $200 billion in market cap in one day. Of course, Alibaba lost $26 billion because the wrong Ma got arrested, but that's a different question. So we looked at managers and markets. And finally, I was pretty harsh on ESG, and I continue to believe it's a scam and a feel-good scam. But the reality is companies have to negotiate a relationship with society. You know, they've got to be good corporate citizens. Otherwise, there's a backlash effect you have to worry about. So with that structure, one of the questions I asked, and it's a subjective judgment, is in your company, where does the power lie? You remember the spectrum I gave you was between 0 and 2. I actually expected people to go 0, 1, and 2, but people went 0, 0.25, 0.28. You must have some really finessed way of estimating corporate governance. I'm truly impressed. No, but basically I said, where does the power lie? And if you look at the conclusion, about 16% of your companies, you concluded that stockholders have no power. My guess is many of these are family group companies like Tata Motors or companies where there are two classes of voting shares. You've decided stockholders have no power. In 56% of companies, you said they have a little power, but perhaps not enough to tilt the scales. In about 12% of companies, the amount of power increases. And in about 16% of companies, you concluded that stockholders, and remember, many of your companies are US companies. The reason I bring that up is there are people who believe US company shareholders must have a lot of power. And you can already see that even among US companies where shareholders supposedly have a lot of power, in most cases, that's not true. In fact, a few semesters ago, and this I have to do after I read the reports, I actually took the reports and I looked at the at where the companies were set up and whether they were small or large and where they were in the world and looked at the breakdown. And in small companies, you saw that if you look at the breakdown of investing, that institutional investors tend to be much larger percentages of shareholding in large companies, in US companies, and in emerging market companies and small companies. The reason we ask this question, of course, is not because we care that much about who the investors are, but it determines how we think about risk. If the bulk of your investors are institutional investors, you can get away assuming that the marginal investor is diversified. And that brings us a huge amount of ammunition because it allows us to use the capital asset pricing model, use beta as a measure of risk. So where does the power lie and who are the marginal investors in your company? So using that marginal investor assessment that the investor is diversified gave us a way of thinking about risk, in particular about hurdle rates and costs of equity and cost of capital. The cost of equity we built up to in three inputs, a risk-free rate. And the only rule we suggest with the risk-free rate, it has to be default-free. It's got to be the currency in which you do the analysis, of course, but it's got to be default-free. With US dollars, of course, you had an easy out. Use the T-bond rate as your risk-free rate. But remember, even there, you are implicitly assuming that the US Treasury will not default. Some of you worked in other currencies, especially emerging market currencies, where a little cleaning up to do to get to a risk-free rate. So if you're doing Indian rupees, you had to start with an Indian government bond rate and clean up for the default risk in that rate because otherwise you risk double counting. For the beta, basically the argument here is your investors are diversified. The only risk they care about is the risk they cannot diversify away, and beta measures that risk. Now, before we look at the different ways you can estimate beta, if you think about the three fundamentals that drive betas. The first is, how discretionary is the product or service you provide? The more discretionary that product or service, the higher your beta as a company. The second thing we looked at was cost structure. The more costs that are fixed costs, other things remaining equal, the higher your beta as a company. Why? Because your earnings become more volatile. And the third factor that drives betas is how much you borrow. And the reason we kind of drill down that, I don't know how many times we use the levered unlevered beta equation, is not because we're in love with that equation, but because we need to make beta as a function of how much you borrow. Otherwise, you can make some really crazy decisions on capital structure or when you do valuation. And finally, on the equity risk premium, and we spent a fair amount on this, we need a base premium for a mature market. If we use the US as a shorthand for a mature market, that base premium can be estimated either by looking at the past, historical data, in which case you're stuck in the past, or by looking forward, an implied equity risk premium. Now, in the 5 months again that we've had this class, we started the class with the equity risk premium at 4.24%. The equity risk premium, the start of May, was 5.15, you've seen almost a one, and that's a big increase for a mature market. If you combine that with the fact that T-bond rates have gone from 1.5% to 3%, just in the course of the last 4.5 months, the cost of equity for a typical company has increased by about 2 to 2.5%. Things can change, even in short periods in mature markets. And the last 4 months are kind of an indication of that. So risk-free rate, beta, equity risk premium. Of course, if you have a company that operates in many countries, you have to deal with risk premiums in those countries. And we talked about estimating an equity risk premium based on a weighted average a way a company operates. So it's not based on where it's incorporated. And then we looked at the two ways you can estimate beta. The traditional way is to run a regression. You have access to a Bloomberg, you can go run a regression of your returns on your stock against returns on a market index. The slope of the line is the beta. That's the way I always start betas. That's where every finance textbook introduces betas. But statistically, and from the perspective of common sense, it's not a great way to estimate betas. And there's three problems. A regression beta is backward looking by definition because you need past returns. It's noisy because it comes with a standard error. And if you have a private company, you can't even estimate a regression beta. So the alternative I suggested, and I was kind of, you know, I've been pushing this as much as I could, is instead of using a regression beta, that you estimate a beta for your company based on the business or businesses itself. Now, as you negotiated this with your company, you realize this did become an issue because some of your companies you felt were unique enough businesses you could not find other companies. There, I suggest you expand your definition of a business. If you define Uber as being in the ride-sharing business and you look for other publicly traded ride-sharing companies, you're going to find only two more. Didi, which is, you know, marginally traded, and Lyft. So if you define business more broadly, you'll get more companies there. And the argument for a bottom-up beta is threefold. First, because of the law of large numbers, you get a more precise estimate of beta. The standard error on a beta estimate when you have 100 betas that you're averaging out is going to be far lower than the standard error on a single beta. Second, rather than be reactive, you can be proactive. You can reflect the business or businesses your company is in right now, not what it used to be at. So if you're looking at Disney, you might bring in the streaming business as a new business that they did not have 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And finally, now you have a way of estimating betas for private businesses because you don't need past prices. So every semester that I teach this class, I keep waiting for the time when everybody in the class will use bottom-up betas. I'm getting close, but it's never, even with this class, I haven't been able, because that's not something I asked you, but I'll check as I read the reports. There will be still holdouts. So this was in spring of 2021. Last year's class, 90% of the class used regression betas. It should be reversed. 90% used bottom-up betas. 8% used regression betas. And then there were 2%. I wasn't quite sure what they were doing, to be quite honest. I hope that that's not the case here. But I'll wager there'll be holdouts in this class. People use regression betas. If you did, you probably used one of the rationales that I've suggested. One is your company so unique you could not find comparable companies because you defined the business too narrowly. The second is, and this is, I think, something that I see happen once in a while where people say, I'm in only one business, so I don't need a bottom-up beta. That's not true, right? If you're in the steel business, you still get the law of large numbers effect by using an average beta for the sector. And the third is something that puzzles me because they say my bottom-up beta is too different from my regression beta. If that were never the case, why would we ever estimate bottom-up betas? It's precisely because the two can diverge that we estimate them. And when the two diverge, the statement we're making is the bottom-up beta is the more reliable number. It's a regression beta that should be dropped. So if you use the regression beta, it's clearly I'm not going to, you know, knock off a point or something, but something to think about when you see people using regression betas, which pretty much 90% of the world does, is to think about the consequences of what happens when you put your weight in one slice of history and one regression. So as you sent in your numbers, I started doing distributions. And I did this morning. I was in a red eye from San Francisco, so I'm a little sleep deprived. So if any of these distributions have strange numbers in them, it's because of my sleep deprivation probably. So I took your beta inputs, your regression betas. That's what the distribution looks like. If this were, you know, 180 randomly picked companies in the market, what should the middle of the distribution look like? It should be centered around one, right? in your case, the median beta is close to one, but it's you know, and this is always the case. When you look at companies picked in this class, the betas will tend to be slightly above one. And as I accumulate the other aspects of your companies, you're going to start to see a pattern. So you pick slightly riskier companies than average. I looked at Jensen's alpha. Again, if this were a random distribution, what should the Jensen's alpha be centered around? 0%. But your Jensen's alpha is, again, slightly positive, slightly riskier than average, slightly more positive than average. And if you look at the R squared for your companies, the median is about 28.7%. It's just low. So you pick companies that are slightly riskier, slightly better performing, and slightly more company specific risk than a typical company. And I blame myself for that because part of the thing is I pushed you away from banks and financial service companies. And part of it is that you like to pick winners. Who wants to pick a loser, right? So there were very few brick and mortar retail companies that were picked. Why? You don't want to deal with companies that are declining, that you basically see the end game in play. I don't think anybody did Bed Bath & Beyond. A lot of people did Nike and Netflix and companies that are exciting that are doing well. So the cost of equity reflects that. Any questions? Let's talk about the cost of capital. So the cost of equity comes from the currency you've chosen to do the analysis in, the risk that cannot be diversified away captured with the beta, and the countries that you operate in captured through an equity risk frame. For the cost of capital, you need to bring in a cost of debt. For some of you, that was made easy by the fact that your company had a rating, because then you trusted the ratings agency. It might be dangerous, but it does save you some trouble. And if your company has an actual rating, I think it does make sense to trust the actual rating, because the ratings agency uses more information than what we use for a synthetic rating, where we look at the interest coverage ratio. The rating gives us a default spread. And here again, the last 4.5 months, you've seen default spreads go up. More for lower rated companies and higher rated companies. Last Friday, I looked at how much spreads have increased just in 2022. For a AAA rated bond, they've gone up about 0.2%. For a BBB rated bond, they've gone up about 0.5%. You add that to your risk-free rate, you now have a much higher cost of debt than you did even at the start of the year. So you can see how things can change even as you watch them as market shift under you. So you got a cost of debt. Of course, you got to take out the tax effect. And there was a little bit of confusion about the marginal tax rate, whether it's 21% and why my numbers are a little higher. I think I have 25 or 27. The reason is actually very simple. The US has multi-layered taxes. Unlike many other countries, we have just one tax rate. In the US, there's a federal tax rate, which is 21%. But then you have state income taxes and local income taxes in the US that add on top of that, which shouldn't puzzle any of us, right? If I asked you, what do you pay as a tax rate? It's not just the federal tax rate. You've got state and local taxes. And if you live in New York City, I mean, think of how much it adds you. So the 25 to 27% reflects the fact that for US companies, once you add state and local taxes, you're going to hit 25%. If you're in California, it might be 27% because California state taxes are higher. But generally, it's almost impossible in the US to get away paying a 21% marginal tax rate and operate anywhere in the US. There's always state income taxes and others because you will get taxed based on where you sell your goods. So you can say, I'm going to go to a no state tax state, but that's going to be a small state. You're going to be selling into California. You're still going to have to pay state income taxes based on where you make your income. So that goes into your after-tax cost of debt. Weights, of course, have to be market value weights. And the last week, there were quite a few people who were looking up debt ratios and capital IQ. Capital IQ debt ratios, as is the case with most service debt ratios, are based on book values. Book value of debt, book value of equity. There's nothing wrong with computing it, but nowhere in finance we really use book debt ratios. Why? Because we just don't trust book equity. It's almost meaningless. In fact, when we talk about return equity, I think there were at least 20 companies we got not meaningful. You know why, right? What happened to your book equity that made your return equity not meaningful? you had negative book equity. It can happen. You know, people often struggle, how do I compute cost of capital with a negative book equity? It doesn't matter. It's not an input into cost of capital because it's based on market values. Of course, you know, market value equity, if you're a publicly traded company, is easy to see. It's a share price times number of shares. If you have multiple class of shares, bring them all in. Market value of debt is a little trickier, right? Because most debt is not traded. Now, if you use book debt as your proxy for market debt, I'm okay with that. Because most of the time, you're going to be pretty close on debt. Book and market debt are going to be pretty close to each other. If you went the extra step and computed the market value of debt, you're going to get a market value that's different, but it's not going to be a third of the debt or twice the debt. It's going to be 90% of the debt or 105% of the debt. But the weights have to be market value weights. Cost of equity times weight of equity, after-tax cost of debt times weight of debt gives you a cost of capital. So I took a look at what your actual debt ratios were because I asked you what's your current debt to cap ratio. And you can see it's a distribution that essentially is, there were no companies with zero debt. You know why, right? That used to not be the case. You used to see companies with zero debt pop up. Now that leases are capitalized, it's almost impossible to find any company with absolutely no debt. There are companies with tiny amounts of debt, 1% debt, 0.5%. But there were no companies with absolutely no debt. But you did pick a lot of companies with a very light debt load. In fact, the median debt ratio across your companies was about 18%, 82% equity. Again, that goes into the types of companies you're picking, slightly riskier than average, have done better than the market, have more company-specific risk, and also tend to carry less debt. So you probably have a disproportionately large number of technology companies in the mix, and that's starting to show up in some of the statistics you see. I don't think I don't know whether anybody did utilities, but if you had lots of utilities in your sample, you're going to see 30, 40, 50% debt ratio show up much more frequently. So those are the actual debt ratios for your companies. Now, once you get the cost of capital, the next thing I asked you is what do your company's existing projects look like? Before you get ambitious about the future, take a look at your existing projects. And there are two ways you can gauge the quality of existing projects. First is to look at everything through the eyes of equity investors and measure the return that they're making on the equity that they've invested in existing projects. And this is going to put us into a minefield, but that's the first approach. You compare that return on equity to the cost of equity. This is the only place in finance, and I'll repeat again, only place where we use book values. And this is a question you might get asked, why when you do return on equity or return on invested capital, do we go back to book values? Because we pledge allegiance to the market value, every other aspect of finance. Why when we compute return on equity and return on invested capital, don't we use market values? Anybody want to give a response to that? Why don't we use market values to compute return equity and capital? Yeah.
There is no data for market values on the.
Why not? It's not on the balance sheet, but it's everywhere, right? In fact, you could argue market value of equity is easier to get than book equity. It's updated every moment of every day.
But the return side?
Net income, right? Still, numerator is still net income. I mean, you could do shareholder returns, stock price returns, but if I could take net income and divide by market equity to get a return in equity, why don't we do that? Yep.
I feel like the market equity could also take like the momentum of the market itself.
And what else? So momentum and what else? If I have a high growth company, I take net income and divide my market value of equity. What am I going to get? Even without telling anything about the quality of the company, what are you going to get as your return equity? A really low number, right? And if I then say you're taking bad projects, you see how unfair it is. The market value of equity reflects not just the equity you've invested in existing projects, but the market gives you credit for things you're going to do in the future. What I want is a return on things you've already done. There is no market value of equity of existing assets, just the total market value of equity. The reason we use book equity is because market equity captures growth assets. Remember that financial balance sheet I showed you? And because of that, we cannot go back to market value of equity. I'm going to book equity very reluctantly. And you can see why, right? Because when you dealt with book equity, it is contaminated by everything accountants have done to it over the history of the company, not just last year, not just 2 years ago, but every single year over time. If your company took a big restructuring charge 7 years ago, it's still there in your book equity. So it's not, so when, you know, when people, again, look at return equity and return invested capital and treat them like magic bullets, you got to remember that those numbers are purely accounting numbers. But to the degree that book equity measures what equity I've invested in existing projects, return on equity then becomes a proxy for the kinds of returns I'm making as an equity investor on those projects. You compare that to the cost of equity, and you're earning more than the cost of equity. We make a shortcut judgment. This company must be taking good projects. But if you're working at this company, you should never be using this measure of quality, right? Because you have cash flows, you can do a net present value. You can do it right within a company, but because we're looking at these companies from the outside, we really can't gauge what their projects look like. We use the shorthand. That's the equity approach. The alternative is I can look at the return on your entire invested capital. One advantage of this is invested capital should turn negative much less frequently. Even invested capital can sometimes turn negative. It's a weird scenario. If you have a huge amount of cash, you're a technology company, and accountants are not putting your biggest assets on the books, but it's far less likely to turn negative. Return on invested capital is the return you're making collectively as debt and equity investors on your projects. It too is an accounting number. Numerator becomes after-tax operating income instead of net income. Denominator becomes book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash. Again, book values. You compare the return capital to the cost of capital. Again, the same kind of conclusion. You're earning more than your cost of capital. You're taking good projects. If you're earning less, you're taking bad projects. But it's a snapshot, and it's an accounting snapshot. So I wouldn't put too much weight on it, because sometimes when things push in the other direction, you might want to go back and say, I don't think this company is actually earning a 30% return on capital. Some of you got outlandishly high returns on capital, 2,000%. It can happen with accounting numbers, companies doing buybacks. You see why buybacks can affect your accounting returns? Because when companies buy back shares and the market value is 5 times the book value, if you buy back 10% of your shares, you could make your book equity go towards zero. Next year, when I look at your return on capital, I get a really high number, not a reflection of great projects, but a reflection of the fact that you've written down your book capital. So here's what, and you can add this on to your typical company. Your typical company is more risky than the average company, has earned a better return than the average company, has more company-specific risk, less debt, and it's also earning a return that exceeds its cost of capital, but by a much healthier percentage. You tended to pick good companies, companies that were doing well. And part of it is because I pushed you away from money losing companies that might be showing up in this statistic as well. Now, the typical company earns less than its cost of capital. So the fact that you're earning 5.59% more than the cost of capital is already a win. The average is pushed up because you have some outliers in the return on capital. But at least according to the numbers, it looks like your companies on average are delivering more than their cost of capital on their existing assets. And I asked you to compute your company's optimal debt ratio. And of course, this is where a black box came in, right? You plug the numbers into my spreadsheet, you came up with an optimal. And if you look at the optimals, it's not, you know, it should be, those are the debt ratios ranging from 10% to 90%. I know it's numbered. But basically, it was about 20% to 30% optimal debt ratios was where you're centered. Now, if you think about why some of your companies at 60, 70, 80% debt ratios, and they did, what is it that caused some of your companies? So this is something I asked you to think about, right? If you got a really low optimal or a really high optimal, what was driving that number? Of all the inputs you had in that capital structure spreadsheet, which one explained really high or really low optimal debt ratios? What are the determinants? One was, of course, the tax rate, right? If any of you tried a 0% tax rate, your optimal very immediately went to zero. In fact, if you haven't tried it, go back to the spreadsheet, change your tax rate to zero. I will promise you that the optimal debt ratio will always be zero. In fact, if it's not zero, let me know. There's something wrong with the spreadsheet. And if I push the tax rate to 70 or 80%, the optimal gets pushed up as well. The number that drives your optimal, if you want to focus in on one number, is that EBITDA number you enter as a percentage of your enterprise value. It's in fact, the flip side of EV to EBITDA that PE investors use all the time. Why does that matter so much? Because if you have a lot of EBITDA relative to enterprise value, you have a lot of cash flows to service debt. If you have a lot of cash flows to service debt, you're going to be able to borrow more money without hitting that tipping point. Remember, every company you hit a point where the cost of capital zooms and your ratings drop off. So companies that are mature companies that produce a lot of cash flows should be able to borrow more money. I plugged in the numbers for Twitter because last week a New York Times columnist called me and he said, you know, Elon is borrowing what, $30 billion on Twitter. Can Twitter afford to borrow that money? I didn't even have to do an optimal capital structure spreadsheet. It's actually very simple to figure out. It can't borrow the money. How much did it have as revenues last year? Does anybody know? But $5.9 billion. When you have $5.9 billion in revenues and you borrow $30 billion, going to 10% debt ratio would be $3 billion of debt, right? If your revenues, this is not income. If your revenues are $5.9 billion and you borrow $3 billion, you're already going to hit single B, triple C. You're going to hit tipping points that you shouldn't be hitting. Clearly, if Musk is borrowing money, it's got nothing to do with Twitter's capacity to borrow money. He's borrowing against his personal wealth. Now, what plans he has to pay that off over time, I don't know. But clearly, this is not debt that is backed up by Twitter's capacity. This is what makes Twitter a very unusual leveraged acquisition, right? Typically, in leveraged acquisitions, the target company is a mature company that's throwing off lots of cash. That's not Twitter. So if you're curious, take Twitter's numbers, put in the optimal capital structure spreadsheet. I think you come up with maybe 10%, 15, if you're lucky. But this is not a company that can carry 60, 70, or 80% debt. So I had your actual and optimal debt ratios for each of your companies. I just compared the two to see what percent of your companies were underlevered and overlevered. So underlevered is where your actual debt ratio is less than the optimal. Overlevered is the reverse. 69% of your companies came in at underlevered. The median company was underlevered by about 8%. So I'm comparing, so if your actual debt ratio is 22%, optimal is 30%. So basically it's underlevered by about 8%. Not a huge amount of excess debt capacity. And that's one thing that's changed since 2017. When the marginal tax rates in the US went from 40 to 21%. Pre-2017, the differences used to be bigger. The median company had more excess debt capacity that shrunk. As the tax rate has come down, optimal debt ratios have also come down. So optimal debt ratios, you're trying to find the mix that minimizes cost of capital. Doesn't mean your company has to go to that mix because it might choose to hold back for whatever reason. As a follow-up to how much can your company borrow, also is what kind of debt is right for your company. Now, I suggested that rather than running, because I ran those four macro regressions, one against interest rates, one against inflation, one against real GDP, and one against exchange rates. But then I added a caveat emptor, which is these regressions are with small samples, and there's going to be a huge amount of noise. So if you try them, you can try them in your company. But for many, you're going to get junk results, numbers that make absolutely no sense. So I suggested you go back to basics, which is you look at a company's typical projects and ask what kind of debt would best match. So if your projects are typically long-term, I say go for long-term debt. If your cash flows are primarily in US dollars, use US dollar debt. I think that's a much stronger way to think about the right kind of debt than actually running the regression. I'm not saying don't run the regressions, but let your intuition basically be the driver of what your company should be doing. And once you come up with the right kind of debt for your company, you can look at their actual debt. And if it doesn't match, you can at least think about why doesn't it match. Baidu borrows primarily in US dollars or euros, and all of its cash flows are in yuan. Why would they do it? And then maybe there's a good reason, and maybe they hedge the risk that comes out of it. But anytime there's a mismatch between the debt you use and the debt you should be using, it is a potential problem for you in terms of, you know, what it means for the future. Towards the end of the class, we talked about how much companies should pay out in dividends. And this isn't rocket science. Start by estimating how much your company could have paid in dividends, a free cash flow equity. I mean, rather than get caught up in the mechanics, think of what we're trying to estimate. We're trying to estimate the cash flows left over after you've met every conceivable need. So we start with net income. We add back depreciation and amortization. We subtract out CapEx, working capital. If you have debt payments to make, you subtract them out. But if you have new debt coming in, that's a cash inflow. What you're left with is a free cash flow equity. You can get every single line item you see there out of the statement of cash flows. Of course, that number could be negative. If you have negative free cash flows equity, clearly you shouldn't be returning cash, even though some companies do. But if it's positive, that is your cap. So one of the questions I asked you was to give me how much your company paid in dividends, how much it used to buy back stock, and how much its free cash flow equity was. No. And you gave me absolute numbers, but then I computed a ratio because the absolute numbers are going to be all over the place, depending on small company, large company, different currencies. No. So if I computed how much first, how much of the cash returned in your company came from buybacks. So in about 46, 47 companies, less than 20% of the cash return came in the form of buybacks. In fact, some of them are all dividends. Many emerging market companies, the only cash return was actually just a dividend. But as you look across the distribution, you can see an increasingly large number of companies now are returning most of the cash that they give back to shareholders in the form of buybacks. It kind of reaffirms that graph you saw. Well, last year, 67% of the cash returned at US companies came in the form of buybacks. This year, it's going to be about the same number. But it's a number that you're also starting to see creep up in other countries as well. Canada's up to 34%. Asian countries are pushing into 20%. So increasingly, companies around the world are pushing from dividends to buybacks. And I think it's a healthy move, to be quite honest, for companies to do it, rather than attach themselves to dividend policies that they cannot maintain if things go bad. And then I compared how much cash return the companies returned as cash, dividends plus buybacks as a percent of free cash flow equity. Remember, 100% is kind of this purest notion of companies on average try to return about 100% of free cash flow equity. But a lot of your companies return well below that. And where does the remaining cash show up? In fact, you can always bring the cash balance of the company as the other half of the picture, right? Because every time you return less than you can, it builds up as a cash balance. There are a few companies at the other end of the spectrum that are paying out way more than they should be. You might have a good reason why that is okay, or you might say, look, they shouldn't be doing this. But if they're paying primarily dividends and they're pushing above their free cash flow equity, you can see why they're reluctant to deal with the problem, because if they do, somebody's going to lose their jobs, the British Petroleum scenario. So look, you know, the dividends and buyback give you a sense of how much cash was returned and how much could be returned. Which brings us to the last part of the project. And I want to kind of look at the last few pages of the packet that I kind of didn't get to in the last session. I mean, there are two ways you can approach valuation. Just like there are, you know, when we did projects, you can look at the equity view or the entire firm. The first is you can try to value the equity in a company by the discounting dividends of free cash flows equity at a cost of equity. What you get as a present value will be the value of equity in a company. Alternatively, you can look at cash flows to the entire firm, which are pre-debt cash flows. You can discount them back at the cost of capital, and what you get as a present value will be the value of the operating assets of the company. That's a choice you have to make very early in the process, because if you don't, your inputs are going to get messed up. And I talked about how the present value might be your end number sometimes. In a dividend discount model, you discount dividends back at the cost of equity, you're done. That's your value per share. When you're valuing equity, free cash flows equity, the cost of equity, you might have some cleaning up to do. Because what you get will be the total value of equity. But if this company has granted options to managers in the past, you now have two equity claim holders. You and I as common stockholders, and then manage their options. So you might have to clean up for those options, take out the value of the options. Yeah.
Like a dumb question, like there's an option market for a lot of our companies analyze.
Just 3 month and 6 month options. Typical employee option is maturity, how long?
Much longer.
10 years, yeah.
Right. So these like short-term options, are they ever taken into account in these values?
Because they have nothing to do with the company.
They're completely separate.
They're just a side market. So if you go to the CBOE, which is where you get these short-term options, there's this bets between people who create the options and people who buy them. The company has not, the reason we care about management options and warrants issued by the company is when those options get exercised, the company has to come up with the shares. So they can increase the number of shares, which is the reason we use option pricing models to value these options. You got to factor in the dilution that might kick in when people try to exercise the options. You don't have to do that with a listed option. So it makes things messier. What's the other thing that makes employee options different from CBOE options? Some of you must have worked at companies where you're given options, right? But they come with conditions. First is vesting. You got to stay around for a bit. And even after you're vested, what's the other constraint you face? You can't sell the options. There is no, I mean, they're trying to create markets, but basically they're illiquid. You're saying, so what? When you buy a CBOE option and things go your way, stock price goes up, you don't usually exercise the option, right? You sell the option to somebody else. It's a time premium. If you have employee options, you can't sell them. You know what's more, if you can't sell them and the price has gone up and you feel the price has gone up too much, employee options get exercised early far more frequently than CBOE. And you can see why, right? Let's say you work at a tech company and 90% of your wealth is now tied in these options. The stock price is soared. Think of working at Zoom a year and a half ago. Stock price is at 300. And you know that this can't last. You see the inside of the company. Say, we're not worth this much. You're going to get far more early exercise. Another problem with traditional option pricing models. The Black-Scholes model. What kind of options do we value with Black-Scholes models? You're saying, what are you talking about? European or American options? European, which means you value options as if they will never be exercised before expiration. Not a big deal when you use it to value CBOE options, but it could potentially overvalue your options with employee options because there is clear evidence that employee options get exercised about halfway to maturity. So you know what you can do, right? Take the Black-Scholes model. If you have employee options, you have an 8-year life, just use 4. You're saying that's very subjective. It's based on the fact that typically employee options get exercised earlier. You got a question?
Do we need to consider convertible bonds?
Convertible bonds do have an option on them, but the nice thing about convertible bonds is they're traded. There's a market value, so it's already there. So you don't have to actually value the options. If you subtract out the value of the entire convertible bond, you've subtracted out both the debt in there and the option. So the nice thing about convertible bonds and warrants is if you subtract out the market value, what's out there, you've already treated them. With employee options, you actually have to value the options yourself because they're not traded. Yeah. Yes?
Usually employee options are pre-decided at stock price.
Usually employee options are issued at the stock price. So let's say stock is trading at about 25. If I grant you options, I grant you at the money options. That's a typical practice. Of course, you don't exercise right away because first you have vesting, but options when they're granted will be at the money. What happens though is as these options age, those at the money options can very quickly become deeply in the money options or deeply out of the money options. If you joined Zoom a year and a half ago at the peak of the stock price, you'd have got employee options, but the strike price would have been $200. You know what those options are worth right now? Close to nothing. So with employee options at the time that they're granted, they're usually 10 years and they're usually at the stock price at which the stock is trading at that. But as you track through time and you value past options, many of these options are 3, 4, 5 years old, you're going to get those options be either in the money or, which means you have to use an option pricing model. One other thing, and this is, I think, from a valuation perspective, has made our jobs easier. Until 2007, I think stock-based compensation took off in the early 1990s. You know why it took off? because Congress, in one of its ill-fated expeditions to create equity in how people were paid, put a cap on management salaries in 92. They passed a law. But at that time, nobody granted options. So when they wrote the law, they wrote it in terms of bonuses and profit sharing and salaries. They did not include options. So companies created options, and in the 90s, they took off. I mean, eventually, so that law became useless, but by the end of the 90s, it was a way in which share-based compensation was given. Along the way, companies also found a bonus, which is accountants had no idea what to do with these options. And because they were granted at the money, accountants said they were worth nothing. Absolutely stupid thing to say, right? An at the money option is definitely not worth nothing. But from an exercise value perspective, they said this option is worth nothing. So when companies granted millions of options, there were no expenses to take care of. It was almost like giving away free money. That's what they thought. In 2007, finally, accounting came to its senses and said, when you give options now, you got to value the options using an option pricing model and show it as an expense. That's a stock-based compensation expense that started showing up into the, and because options were no longer free, at least in the face of it, companies have shifted away from options to a much more sensible stock-based compensation mechanism, which is RSUs are restricted stock. Basically, they're shares. They're easier to work with in valuation because they're shares like any other shares, but they do come with a restriction, which is you can't trade those shares. That's a restricted part of the shares. They're like illiquid shares. But from a valuation perspective, you can just add them to the share count and get away with it. But options, you actually have to value as options. And if you discount free cash flows to the firm at the cost of capital, God's sakes, don't stop there because your work has just begun. Because use free cash flow to the firm and you start with operating income. Any asset whose income is not part of operating income hasn't been valued yet. So we said you need to add cash if you're valuing Apple. You need to value add cross holdings if you're valuing a family group company. You need to subtract our debt because you're still interested in the equity. And if you have options outstanding, you need to subtract that. So there's a lot of cleaning up to do to get to the value of equity if you're discounting free cash of the firm at the cost of capital. 90% of the DCFs you will see out there will be the free cash of the firm discounted. But be very careful. I see people mismatching cash flows and discount rates all the time. What do I mean by that? I see people taking free cash flow to equity, which is after debt payments, and discounting at the cost of capital. You'd be amazed at how often these valuations pass off as okay in M&A. So when you look at your next DCF, check to make sure there's consistency before you even look at the assumptions that go into the valuation. So I'm going to do a couple of valuations. You can at least get a flavor of traditional valuation. Let's start easy. Let's start with the dividend discount model. Remember I said I was going to value Deutsche with a dividend discount model? And the reason I used to do this pre-2008 was desperation. If you try to estimate the free cash flow equity for a bank, you run into a little bit of a measurement issue. You can start with net income, but to get to free cash flow equity, you need to subtract out CapEx and add back depreciation and subtract change in working capital. Try doing that for a bank. You very quickly will drive yourself crazy. Because what's CapEx for a bank? What's working capital for a bank? So pre-2008, at some point, you threw up your hands and said, I don't know what the free cash flow equity is for this bank, but I do know what they pay in dividends, and banks are run by sensible people. That's the assumption that drives this. Therefore, I would discount the dividends back, and that would be the value of my equity. It remained the last bastion for the dividend discount model because people couldn't estimate cash flows. So in 2008, when I valued Deutsche, I decided to use the dividend discount model because basically I said, no, what else can I do? It's a bank. So I projected out net income. I projected out a payout ratio to be roughly what it is today. So think of this as a status quo. I'm taking the existing net income, I'm letting it grow over time at a growth rate of 5.4% and assuming the payout ratio stays at 54%. So for the next 5 years, I have a growth rate of 5% of payout ratio of 54%. I get expected dividends. I discount them back at the cost of equity because it is an equity cash flow. I get the present value of dividends for the next 5 years. Am I done? What have I left undone here? I've taken the present value of dividends for the next 5 years. But at the end of 5 years, the company doesn't go away. I've got to do something. I've got to apply closure. And in discounted cash flow model, the way we apply closure is we assume a growth rate beyond year five that can be sustained forever, a perpetual growth rate. And I suggested a very simple rule for this perpetual growth rate. I said, cap it at the risk-free rate. So in this case, I actually set a growth rate of 3% a year in perpetuity, well below the risk-free rate. That 4% is the risk-free rate. I set it at 3%. Why? Because banks are not going to be the highest growth companies in an economy. I did estimate how much they could pay out by assuming that after year five, that Deutsche would earn a return on equity roughly equal to its cost of equity. I'm assuming something about the entire sector becoming more competitive over time. And of course, you can override it, let a company earn above its cost of equity. But my payout ratio after year five is 65% or 64.7%. So first thing I would strongly suggest you do with discounted cash flow models is don't take today's payout ratio and keep it going through time while bringing the growth rate down, because that's not fair to a company. So for the next 5 years, Deutsche pays 54% payout ratio as a 5.4% growth rate. After year five, it pays out 65% and is a 3% growth rate. To get my terminal value, I get the expected net income in year six. I go to net income. I don't do dividends in year six. I do net income in year six, and I multiply by the new payout ratio to get my new dividends. Always, so when you're doing valuation, always keep that terminal year, the extra year separate, so you can reassess every number. You can't just take year five dividends and grow them at 3%. Even though people do it all the time, don't go down that path. It's not fair to the company. It's not going to give you a decent valuation. That gives me a terminal value of 62.3 billion euros. I'm almost home. I need to discount that back to today because I'm not going to get the terminal value until the end of year five. To discount it back, I use today, there's actually two costs of equity floating around here. One is my cost of equity for the next 5 years, 9.23%. And one is my cost of equity after year five, 8.5%. I use the 8.5% cost of equity to get my terminal value. But to discount it back to today, I use the cost of equity for the first 5 years. And let me give you the logic for that. To get to year five, I've got to live through the next 5 years. If my next 5 years are risky, it reduces the value of my terminal value. And I'm factoring that in when I do the discounting. So you add those up, you get a value of equity of 49.7 billion. I checked to see whether Deutsche options outstanding. They either had none, or if they did have some, they didn't report on them. So I'm taking the share count that I have, and I get a value per share of 105 euros. So again, let me break it down. Dividend discount model, you project out dividends for what I'll call a high growth period. In that period, your payout ratio could be 0%. So this notion that you cannot use a dividend discount model to value a stock that doesn't pay dividends is actually not true. You could have zero payout for the next 5 years while you grow at a high rate. But at the end of year five, if you bring the growth rate down, you then have to reestimate a payout ratio based on the growth rate. Don't leave it at 0% because that's, you know, bringing them, giving them low growth and making them reinvest like they used to. And then bring the two present values together to get a value per share. So since Disney was the company we started the class with, let's kind of put it, use it as a company to bring closure to valuation. For Disney, I broke their growth period down into two phases. The first is a phase where their growth rate is going to be 6.8% a year every year. I'm going to call it a status quo valuation. Let me explain why I use those words. I'm going to do a valuation of Disney where I let things continue the way they were last year, run by the existing management. That existing management has earned a return on capital of 12.6%, reinvested 54% of their after-tax operating income, and you combine those numbers, my growth rate is 6.8%. So for the next 5 years, I have 6.8% growth, 54% reinvestment, 12.6% return on capital. Then I'm in year six, right? And I would suggest when you're doing discounted cash flow valuation, if you try to estimate year six, you're very quickly going to again pull your hair out saying, I have no idea what's going to happen. So I'm going to do something very strange. Because I have trouble estimating year six, I'm going to go to year 11. What happens in year 11? I make Disney a mature company, growing at a rate less than or equal to the growth rate of the economy. I give them a 2.5% growth rate. I give them the characteristics of a mature company, a lower return on capital, a lower beta, lower cost of capital. And I get my stable growth inputs. And then all I do in my transition phase is move my numbers down from what they are now to my stable growth. So as an example, if my growth rate is 6.8% for the first 5 years and 2.5% after year 10, I go 6.8 to 2.5 in 5 linear steps. So my transition phase is just an adjustment period where I adjust every single input from what it is now to what I think it'll be as a mature company. So there's my Disney base case valuation. I project out my after-tax operating income at 6.8%. I subtract out the reinvestment. The reinvestment is 54%. I get free cash flows for the first 5 years. Beyond year 10, I give it a 2.75% growth rate. I adjust the cost of capital. I compute a terminal value. Year 6 through 10, all that's happening again is changing from where I am now to where I think the company will be in steady state. Every single number on this sheet was a number we've used elsewhere in corporate finance. If you look at the cost of capital, that's your existing cost of capital based on a bottom-up beta, the debt ratio they have as a company, their actual rating. So if you look at that present value that I get of $62.56, it reflects my valuation of the company based on the inputs that I've come up with, based on the analysis we've done through the class. You're saying, why aren't you using an optimum? The words, keywords are status quo. I'm essentially letting the company be run the way it is. And this is a company that's not going to be aggressive about using debt. The value per share reflects it. The actual stock price was pretty close, $67.71. So I asked you to value and price your company. Now, and you gave me both the numbers, and your median company was slightly overvalued. So if this number is negative, you're basically finding a company to be undervalued. The median company was slightly overvalued, but not by a huge amount, by about 4%. 43% of your companies came in as undervalued, 57% or 58% came out as overvalued. I mean, the valuation class, of course, this is the entire project is doing your valuation. I mean, for you, it was the last week of the class. So in a sense, you didn't get a chance to take a look at the numbers in a way that could have shifted the numbers. So it's much more likely to reflect what you've already discovered as actual numbers of your company. And just to give you a sense of comparison to classes past, I mean, this is from spring 2008 to spring 2021, the breakdown of, so basically I did the same breakdown that I did for your class every single semester. So you can look in spring of 2008, for instance, the percent of companies that came in the number to focus on is pick any one cell and look at the percentage that come out as undervalued. Spring of 2021. No, the median company was overvalued by about 28%. So at least you're moving towards the value. It's 28 to 4%. But that might reflect the fact that during the course of the semester, you've seen a pretty significant marking down of stock prices at your company. The price has moved towards value. The value hasn't moved up. The price has moved down towards value. One final point. I know the value, as I said, is a status quo value. But along the way with your company, you also ask questions like, what's the right debt ratio for my company? Can it pay out more in dividends or less in dividends? I mean, I'm not saying you're ready to take over CEO of the company you've analyzed, but you have the ammunition to at least suggest making changes. And if you break down how a restructuring works, it's about changing the things in a company that enhance value. So you boil down every action in restructuring. You're starting with existing cash flows. Like, can I run my company more efficiently? Can I create more cash flows from existing assets? When you're looking at growth, you're looking to see, is there a way I can increase the value I generate from future growth by either earning a higher return on capital or by reinvesting more? With the cost of capital, it becomes, can I lower my cost of capital by changing the mix of debt and equity, matching my debt up to my assets? And in terms of mature growth, you're basically saying, can I put that off for a much longer period by building up competitive advantages? Everything you do in business is built around this framework, right? I mean, you might not think of marketing and ESG and public, or whatever sector you're in, it's somewhere in there. Your job is, in a sense, is to tell me where it shows up. So that's what I mean about challenging buzzwords. There's nothing wrong with using the word strategic, but when you use the word strategic, you're not telling me much. I want to know what that means so I can find something to shift. I'm on your side. Basically, if you're a marketing person, we should do this. My job is to say, what will change my valuation and doesn't make sense? So it's not about stopping people who want to be creative and try new things. It's about taking what they're doing and saying, this is where it'll show up. And so once in a while, they will be disappointed because they try it out and actually turns out to give a lower value than you have today. But that's the nature of business. There are some things that look creative and great, but when you try them out, can actually lower your value. So I took Disney and I said, I think I can fix it. I mean, this is hubris, right? I've never run an entertainment company. I have no idea what. But looking at the numbers, there are some things that looking at the numbers tell me Disney could do. One obvious thing is they were, you know, at a 12% debt ratio. And from the optimal debt ratio calculation, they could be at 40. So I moved them to the optimal. The second is if you look at their reinvestment rate, and they're actually earning a lower return on capital than they used to 5 or 10 years ago. They're putting money into businesses that are sucking up cash. If they can find a way to get a slightly higher return on capital, so 12.6%, move back to 14, which is still lower than the 18% they earned 5 or 6 years ago. That's going to push up growth and push up the value of growth. With those changes, put it, the value that I get for Disney is $74.91. You remember the value I got with the status quo is about 62. Where's the extra $13 coming from changes I can make to a company? This is not part of your project, but if you take the Excel spreadsheet to value your company, and you say, what could I do differently at this company? Maybe try a little more debt. Maybe reinvest more or reinvest less, depending on the business they're in. You'll see value shift. That is, to me, the value of control, that you run the company, you can change the way it's run. It's going to show up as a different value for your company. So I was looking at your list of companies to see where the potential for change was greatest. I look for what I call my triple whammy, which is, these are companies that are underlevered. So basically, their actual debt ratio is below the optimal by at least 10%, are building up cash. They're paying out less than their free cash flow equity by about 10%, and are also undervalued by about 10%. You see why I call it a triple whammy? If I could buy this company, I'm getting a company that's priced less than the value, that has debt capacity and cash available. You know, the one way in which we know you can make money as an investor is if you can predict which companies are most likely to become targets of acquisitions before they become targets. Think of this as a very crude start on that process. If you took a list of all US companies, where would I most likely find targets? An undervalued company with underlevered, just a cash buildup would be one candidate. These are the companies that came through. Now, I'm not suggesting you jump out and button. Intel's on that list. It's undervalued, underlevered, has a cash buildup. Targets on that list, some big names on that list. Companies where even if you don't have an acquisition, change could increase value. So if you're the Carl Icahn, the next Carl Icahn to kind of push markets, these are the kinds of companies you're going to focus on. Twitter's not on that list, right? If Musk is targeting Twitter, it's got, for other reasons, it's got nothing to do with undervaluation or changing leverage or returning more cash. But if you're looking for companies where change is likely to give you the biggest bang for the buck, this is where you're going to find it. Any questions? We'll start with a page, we'll end with this page, right? It's been a long journey, but started and said the three base principles in corporate finance, the investment principle, the financing principle, the dividend. Let me state them again. You tell me whether you have a little bit more to hang on to than in the first session. Here's what the investment principle says. Go out and find investments. It could be acquisitions, could be projects, could be assets that earn a return that is greater than your minimum acceptable hurdle rate. At that point, you say, what's the return? And I gave you the sub principle. Return should be based on cash flows. Remember the Disney theme park, cash in, cash out, should reflect when the cash flows come in. That's what the discounting does. And have all side effects built in. Remember how we brought in synergy into the Tata Motors acquisition of Harman Audio, a Bookscape adding an online retail. Return should be based on cash flow, should reflect the timing, should have all side effects built in. When it comes to hurdle rates, I said hurdle rates should reflect the risk in the investment, not the risk of the entity looking, but the risk in the investment. That's why we made a big deal about estimating different costs of capital for each of Disney's different businesses, because it's not fair to take Disney's cost of capital and apply it to the streaming business, a very different business. The hurdle rate should reflect the risk of the business you're in. And we measure that risk. If you're a publicly traded company, is the risk that cannot be diversified away. The reasoning being, if your investors are diversified, what they think about is the risk added to their portfolios. That's what beta measures. It should also reflect the mix of debt and equity used to fund the project. Where does it show up? The weights in your cost of capital. The hurdle rate becomes the cost of capital if you're looking at the entire business. Take good investments. It's not rocket science. Earn more than your cost of capital. It doesn't have to be next year. It could be nothing here suggests you need to be short term. Right? This is your long-term return on capital has to exceed your long-term cost of capital. The financing principle says find a mix of debt and equity that minimizes your hurdle rate. Why? Because a lower hurdle rate will allow you to take more projects and make all your existing projects more valuable. And the type of debt you take should be matched up to the assets you have, because by doing that, you minimize default risk. And finally, in the dividend principle, we said if you cannot find investments that make your hurdle rate, give the cash back to the shareholders. And you can give it back in the form of dividends or buybacks, depending on what your shareholders prefer. This has nothing to do with you. It's got to do with what your shareholders prefer. If you remember when we talked about dividend policy, we talked about some companies accumulating shareholders who like dividends, older, poorer investors, pension funds among institutional investors. Those companies, if they have cash returns, should try to return them in dividends. If they don't want to increase regular dividends, they can pay a special dividend. But if your company is accumulated shareholders who don't like dividends, then buy back stock. It's just a different way of returning cash. And in doing all of this, you have a singular objective. You want to maximize the value of the business. In fact, that picture I showed you about Disney, every single part of corporate finance is in there, right? The investment principle drives your growth rate through the return on capital. The financing principle drives your cost of capital. That's what discounts the cash flows. The dividend principle determines your reinvestment rate. That's how many you put back in the business. You could actually teach corporate finance with a valuation framework where every single box becomes something in corporate finance. But I really don't think you can value companies without understanding corporate finance. But people try it all the time. That's why they completely miss what buybacks do in a company. They do weird stuff when a company increases debt ratios. You need to be able to know how to at least run a business if you want to value it. And that's what corporate finance is all about, is the first principles that drive how running a business is. Now, I'll be quite honest, you have enough ammunition to be able to value companies now. The only thing you'll get in the valuation class is more grounding, more telling stories, more being able to write. So if you, this summer you have a job where you have to value companies, don't feel under-equipped. You're just as equipped as somebody who's been a three-year analyst to be able to value companies because you know the right questions to ask. And don't assume that just because somebody's been doing this for a long time that they know what they're doing, because it's amazing what passes for expertise in corporate finance evaluation. Now, I think in the first session, I gave you my objectives for the class. I don't know whether I've gotten even remotely close. It's probably dangerous to ask you about this just after you've turned in your final project or on the verge of it. First, I said, this is a class about the big picture. I know at times you got lost in the details, right? The tax rate, should I use a marginal or effective tax rate? Elevate, keep pushing yourself up. When you're in doubt, say, where does this fit in? What am I trying to do? It's amazing how asking those two questions and answering them will often give you the right thing to do, no matter what roadblock you run into. Second, I mean, there are lots of tools in corporate finance, but they are tools. There's an optimal capital structure too. That's what this spreadsheet is. But it's not going to tell you what the optimal debt ratio for a company is. It's not automatic. You take the tool, you come up with an assessment, and then you make a judgment as to whether you should move towards that optimal debt ratio. And your conclusion might be, we're not going to do it. And this company doesn't make sense right now to do that because it's too dangerous. It's your tool. It's not going to drive what you do. And the same thing can be said about every other tool in corporate finance. And finally, you know, I told you corporate finances fund right now, it doesn't feel like it. But here's what I want you to do. Every time you read a business news story from now, I want to read the news story and say, does this make sense? What are they trying to do? So when you read about Musk taking over Twitter and he's borrowing $30 billion, go through the mechanics of what is an optimal, what can Twitter afford to borrow? You don't have to put it in an optimal capital structure spreadsheet. When you see a big buyback being announced, when you see a company's stock price get knocked down because of a news story, think through the common sense based principles of corporate finance. It's amazing how the stories get to be less mysterious. That's about it. One final thing, and this is from purely selfish perspective. You have to do your CFEs between now and, I don't know, the end of this week. For God's sakes, do them. You know why? Because if you don't do them, you can't check your grade. And if you can't check your grade, guess who bears the pain? I start getting emails saying, I can't find my grade. Now, I'd rather that you just turn in the damn CFE, get it out of the way, you know, so that when the grade comes out, you can see it on Brightspace pop up. I don't know what they actually do. They blank out. I've never been on the receiving end of this, but my guess is you try to check a grade, it shows a blank spot saying you didn't turn in your CFE. At some point, they have to release your grade. So if you don't care, it's 3 months from now, it'll be on my transcript. But if you want to check your grade next week, it's probably a good idea to get the CFE done. I'll send you the link in case you haven't been doing your CFEs. But that's about it. Thank you very much. And it's been an interesting semester. I mean, I taught all semester with a mask on. I hate it. I feel like my oxygen runs short at times, even though I had plenty of oxygen, just completely psychological. I usually get better over the day, I guess, because I learned to live with less oxygen or whatever. No. But the thing is, I wouldn't recognize any of your faces, to be quite honest, because most of your faces have been covered. So next semester, if you come back for value, next spring, if you come back for evaluation, I don't teach in the fall. Now, reason is very simple. I live in California much of the year. And this way, I get all my teaching done in 15 weeks. So you know, if you're coming back for evaluation this spring and you have no mask on, I don't recognize you, I apologize in advance. I've seen you. Maybe you should continue to wear your mask for the rest of eternity. No. But next spring, hopefully, none of us will be wearing masks and we'll be back to a regular environment. Thank you. Yeah, okay.